Good evening, everyone. Good to see everyone. Hope everyone had an okay week since we last saw each other. And we are going to do a bunch of shorter pieces tonight, as I mentioned last time. We're going to get through three sugyot, which are kind of shorter to the point, and a couple of interesting diversions along the way, which will come by way of Tosafot and a couple other parallels. A reminder that last time we spent a whole bunch of time about whether cases, trials can begin at night and where that came from, various other parallels, Nigaim, Tzara'at, scale disease, other areas of Jewish law where day and night is relevant, inheritance law, etc. And we ended up with a bunch of intricate texts, but that got us back to the Mishnah's basic split, which is that Dine Mamonot are begun in the day and can be completed at night, whereas Dine Nefashot have to be completed the next day, which is the piece that we're picking up on now. A reminder, so the language from the Mishnah, again, is Dine Mamonot, Danin Bayom Vegomrin Balaila. This is back on Lamed Bet Amud Aleph, if you're following at home. Dine Mamonot, Danin Bayom Vegomrin Balaila, Dine Nefashot, Danin Bayom Vegomrin Bayom. So civil monetary cases have to be begun in the day, but you can conclude them at night, whereas capital cases are begun in the day and they must be completed in the day. And that's the piece that we're going to now start with exploring. So we're here at the bottom, okay? And the question again that we're asking is, how do we know that capital cases have to be concluded in the day? Okay, that's the question. And concluded here seems like it's going to include both the verdict and executing. You'll see in a moment why those are actually more deeply linked than you might think. And I'll be interested in this case, as I always am, for parallels and ways in which there are or are not any traces of this in American law. Okay, so Dine Nefashot Danin Bayom v'chulei. Menahame mile. How do we know that? Amar Rav Shimi Bar Chia, Amar Kra, Vehoka otam lashem neged hashamish. Okay, so this is a pasuk. I think I have this nicely on the side of this fancy version that I've got here. Verse 14, tiny letters. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, kach et kol rashei ha'am vehoka otam lashem neged hashamish. V'yashov charon af Hashem Yisrael. V'midbar kav hei, it's the story of Baal Peor, Benot Moab, kind of a combination of mass apostasy with mass promiscuity going on in the later part of the Dor HaMidbar's sojourn in the desert. And this is already the younger generation. And you've got here a scene where there starts to be a magefa, there starts to be a plague. And God tells Moshe, we'll come back to this piece later, take all the heads of the people, okay? But whoever is being dealt with here, hoka otam, all right? So we have this verb, hoka lehokia, which usually, if you look up in JPS and things like that, will say impaled, okay? But there are four mitot bedin, four formal kinds of execution, in rabbinic law. We've got skila, soifa, hereg, and chenek, burning, not burning at the stake. It was a different kind of procedure. We'll come back to that actually later also. Stoning, also not really what you classically think of as stoning, but a form of killing someone with a rock. Hereg, which is beheading, and chenek, which is strangulation. And basically rabbinic sources want to sort of read everything into that in one way or another, the procedures that they have around that. And one of their assumptions about skila, about stoning, which we'll also come back to, is kol haniskalin nitlin. But actually, as part of the process of stoning someone, the final phase of that was to hang their dead body up on a gallows. Why is that important? If we can prove that hoka'otan, okay, that this hoka'a is somehow a form or an element of a formal capital punishment, and it says neged hashemesh, opposite the sun, and we take that to mean while the sun is still up, then we potentially have a proof, or we would have a proof from this verse, that you thereby know that executions can only happen in the day, and the assumption being the closure of the capital case, of the capital process, can only happen in the day. All right, so Rav Shimi Bar Chiya is saying, the verse tells you, hoka'otam neged hashemesh, while the sun is still up. Amar Rav Chista, minayin lehoka'a shehi tliya. All right, so now we're going to close that loop. What Rav Shimi Bar Chiya seems to have assumed, how do you know that hoka'a is just another term for hanging? Dichtiv. And now we get a pasuk from Shmuel Bet, which we're going to go into in depth in a moment. Dichtiv v'hoka'anum l'ashem b'givat Sha'ul b'chir Hashem. Hoka them, okay, to God on Giv'ah of Sha'ul, the town of Giv'ah that is Sha'ul's hometown, the one who was chosen by Hashem. Uchtiv, and it further says, v'tikach ritzpa bataya et asak v'tateyula el hatzur bitchilat katzir. Okay, so let's just go into the story here and understand what's happening. And it's also important for understanding what Rashi does here, which is quoting a Gemara from elsewhere, but it's quite a profound point. This is in the document that I put the link up to, so if you want to just go into that yourself, you can. Okay, so there's a story here in Shmuel Bet Kaf Aleph. For those, I mentioned Yochi Brandis is a Pardesh Akiva, the orchard. For those who have spent any time with the secret book of Kings or Malachim Gimel in the original, this is an extremely important passage for her on a range of levels. But here, I'm just going to read us through this story. This is towards the end of Shmuel Bet, where we get a bunch of assorted stories from near the end of David's career as king. Vayira'av bimei David shalosh shanim, shana achrei shana. There was a three-year drought without interruption. Vayivakesh David et pnei Adonai. Vayomer Adonai el Shaul ve'el beit hadamim asher al asher himit et hagibon. All right, so David seeks out God's presence for counsel, and Hashem says back, el Shaul ve'el beit hadamim. This drought is directed to Shaul and the blood guilt of his house for having killed the Givonim, having massacred a number of the Givonim. Vayikra ha-melech la-givonim vayomer aleihem. So the king, that is to say David, summons the Givonim and says to them, and now we get an editorial note, v'ha-givonim lo mi b'nei Yisrael hema, ki imi yeter ayem ori, u'v'nei Yisrael nishbe'u lahem, vayivakesh Sha'ul la-hakotam, bekanoto livnei Yisrael v'yuda. The Givonim were not Israelites. They were actually remnants from the Emori, that is to say, the indigenous peoples of the lands. They were a kind of Canaanite. And what had happened, and this story you can see back in Sefer Yoshua, if you don't remember it, the Israelites took an oath to the Givonim not to kill them. Basically, what happens is Yoshua and his armies, many of you will recall, start having unstoppable victories. And there's a little pocket of people from Givon who are indigenous who say, forget it, there's no way we can prevail over these guys. And we can see that these guys are slaughtering all of the natives. They're not leaving anyone alive. So they dressed up like foreigners and they went in the presence of Yoshua and they said, we come from a faraway land. We want to, you know, sign a treaty with you. And Yoshua and the Zakenim, the elders under this false pretense, agree, sign a treaty, and take an oath. Then it comes out later They realize that these people are indigenous Canaanites, and then they can't break the oath. But later on, when Shaul finally gets, you know, sort of the monarchy, as it's described here, in his zeal for Israel and Judah, he finally lashes out at those people who took advantage of the Israelites. But the whole point of this story is Shaul did that because he felt that was sort of the ultimate move of loyalty to do for his people. But God was extremely angry about this, okay? The plain sense is just that they violated an oath. As you'll see when we get to Rashi's commentary later in the Gemara, the rabbinic understanding of this story is that the Givonim actually converted to Judaism under false pretenses, you know, for material motive, all of these things, but that they actually became Jews. All right, we'll come back to that later. In any event, David, having learned that the reason for the drought is Shaul's massacre of the Givonim, goes to the remnants of that community and says, "Vayomer David al Givonim, Ma'a selachem, uvama achaper uvarchu et nachalat Adonai." So what do I do to make up for it so that God's people, God's inheritance, will be blessed again with rain? Vayomru lo agivonim, ein lanu kesef v'zahavim Shaul v'im beito, v'ein lanu ish la'amit b'Yisrael. We don't have any claim of money, and we don't have any specific person we want to kill. We don't have a vengeance claim for, you know, a particular person. Vayomer, we'll see that's modified in a moment. Vayomer, ma atem omrim eselachem. Tell it to me straight. What do you want? I'll do it. Vayomru el ha-melech, ha-ish asher kilanu v'asher dima lanu, nishmadnu me'itiyatzev b'chol gvul Yisrael. The man who tried to destroy us and wipe us out so that we couldn't be anywhere in Israel's territory, that is to say, Shaul, Yutan lanu shiva anashim mibanav, vehoka'anum ladonai begivat Shaul bechir Adonai, vayomer ha-melech ani eten. We want 7 descendants of the man who tried to kill us, namely Shaul, and we want them, now you see here, vehoka'anum, that verb, we want hoka'ah to be done to them on the hill, but literally it's the town of Giv'ah. This is not, you know, not far out of Yerushalayim. I think there's an Arab town, Jib, that is on what's thought to be the remains of that area. Giv'at Shaul, who was God's chosen, and David says, "Ani eten, yes, I will hand them over." Vayachmol ha-melech al mefivoshet ben Yehonatan ben Shaul. Now, when picking out which 7 descendants of Shaul he was going to hand over to the Givonim to be killed, the king spared Yehonatan's son Mephibosheth. You'll see in a minute there's another Mephibosheth, so don't get confused. But the Mephibosheth, the son of Yehonatan, was spared because of the oath between David and Yehonatan. Just parenthetically, it's like a weird formulation, like because of the oath, as if otherwise he would have handed over Yehonatan's kid. You might have thought it was Ahavat, you know, Yehonatan or something like that. But formally, it's like, I made an oath, Ben Zari uVen Zaracha, Haftarah for Machar Chodesh, that I won't hurt your kids. That comes into play now. Vayikach HaMelech, so who does he go for? Et shnei b'nei ritzpah v'ataya asher yaldeh l'Shaul et armoni v'et mefivoshet. So first he goes for the kids of Shaul's concubine, ritzpah v'ataya, 2 kids there, armoni and mefivoshet. V'et chameshet b'nei michal bat Shaul asher yaldeh l'Adriel ben Barzilai ha-mecholati. And the 5 sons of Michal, the daughter of Shaul, whom she had given birth to through Adriel ben Barzilai. Now, if you know the larger story here, I thought it said, "Ulamichal bat Shaul lo haya yaled ad yom mota." It says elsewhere in the Haftarah for Shmini that Michal never had any kids. So indeed, in a number of Hebrew manuscripts and in a bunch of the versions of the Septuagint and in a number of translations, this word Michal is actually rendered Meirav. That is to say, the other daughter of Shaul. That makes a lot more sense. in a certain way, though it also screams out that it might have been a correction by someone who knew the other pasuk and was like, well, that must be a mistake, that it's Michal. I'm not going to give away too much of Malachim Gimel and Yochi Brandes, but put it, suffice it to say, Brandes in her novel makes a big deal out of the fact that one, it says Michal here, and two, it says that Michal did not have a child, but it never says that Michal was an akara, the way it does with other women in the Bible. And that leads to a very creative plot twist of how perhaps Michal, maybe there's more to her story than you might say. I highly recommend the book. In any event, whoever their mother was, these are five other descendants of Shaul. Vayitznem b'yad ha-givonim, vayoki'um bahar lifnei Adonai, vayiplu shvatam yachad, vehema umtu b'imei katzir barishonim b'tchilat katzir se'orim. So they're handed over to the givonim, and they have this hoka'ah done to them. Again, we're not sure what that means yet, and most translations will translate it as impaled. Seven of them die all at once. They were killed in the height of the wheat harvest, so it's the middle of the summer. The barley harvest, the beginning of the barley harvest. It's heading into the height of summer. You'll see it's important. It's not the rainy season, because we're going to get a date now. Vatikach ritzpah vataya et hasak. Their mother's still alive, two of them, right? The mother of two of them is certainly still alive. And she takes sackcloth. Vatatehu lach el hatzur, mitchilat katzir ad nitach maim alayam min ha-shamayim, velo natna of ha-shamayim lanuach alayam yomam, ve'et chayat ha-sadeh laila. She takes this sackcloth and leans it over on the rock. Our sugya uses this as a proof of what's she doing with the sackcloth. She must be covering them. If she's covering them, their bodies must be exposed. If their bodies are exposed, for all to see, they must be hanging. And that's how we know that hoka'ah is a form of hanging. She does this, just to finish the story, until water falls on them from the sky, which it means until the yoreh, until it starts to rain again, which means she's out there for several months, and now we see what her concern is, making sure that their bodies are not pecked apart by birds or scavenged by wild beasts. David hears what Shaul's concubine does. Vayelech David vayikach et atzmot Shaul ve'et atzmot Yonatan ben Omeal me'et ba'alei Yavesh Gilad, Asher gandu otam merchov Beit Shan, Asher tla'um shama plishtim beyom akot plishtim et Shaul ba'gilboa, vayal misham et atzmot Shaul ve'et atzmot Yonatan beno, ve'yasfu et atzmot amukaim, ve'ikberu et atzmot Shaul ve'yonatan beno be'eretz Binyamin be'tzela, ve'kever kish aviv, ve'yasu kol asher tziva ha'melech, ve'ye'ater Elohim la'aretz achreche. David is moved by this, realizes, I can't let this go on. He gathers back the bones of Shaul and Yonatan, which had been in the custody of the people of Yavesh Gilad on the east side of the Yarden. They recovered them from the Plishtim after the Battle of the Gilboa. And he gathers their bones and the bones, the body of the ones that had been Mukaim, again here understood to be hung, and he buries them all together. Shaul finally gets a burial with the rest of his family, and then God answers the land, that is to say, rain comes. Okay, that's an amazing story. Obviously, we could do a long Tanakh shiur just on that. Why did I bother doing that whole sidebar? So the first is so you understand how they're using hoka and the ways in which they are reading the text there in order to get a proof of execution happens in the day. And we see that because hoka'ah is a form of execution, which is the hanging associated with stoning. And it was done neged Hashemesh, as described in Bemidbar. But we learn from this story in Shmuel that hoka'ah means hanging. Now, Rashi quotes another Gemara here, which I just think is kind of remarkable in terms of understanding what's going on. Vatikach ritzpah bataya. So first the proof, alma migulina yu. So that shows that their bodies were exposed from the fact that she needed to take sackcloth to cover them. Lefishatluin al ha'etzim, because they were hanging on the trees, gallows. Ve'imishum lo talin nivlato al ha'etz. And if you come, and Rashi is really just quoting a Gemara in Yevamot here, okay? If you say, how could David have allowed that? Right? On the assumption that David is a faithful, pious, and, you know, observant of normative halacha Jew, right? How could David have allowed these bodies to be up there? You're not allowed to have a body hang overnight. Lo talini vlato al ha'etz, says the Torah. Hashaninan laba yevamot, that problem was resolved in a sugya in Yevamot. Mutav teyaker otachat patorah v'yitkadesh shem shamayim befarhesya. It is better to uproot a letter from the Torah. And here letter does not mean like, you know, aleph or bet. It means like one line item from the Torah. Better that this prohibition on leaving bodies hang be violated, and we get the benefit of God's name being sanctified in public. How is God sanctified in public? By having all the bodies of Shaul's kids hang. Sheyehu akol ro'in otan v'sho'alin mativan shaleilu. So that people would pass by and say, who are these people? What are these bodies that are hanging? Halalu b'nei melachim hem. Actually, they're princes. Ufashtu yadam begerim gururim. And they took it upon themselves to go after, to harass, really, to massacre. Gerim gururim. Gerim gururim is a kind of insulting term for a convert that sort of finds a way to get dragged along for the ride, is the best way I can translate it idiomatically. The idea is that gerim gururim are people who are insincere converts. They're just finding a way to get in for whatever reason, like the givonim were. It's in their interest to do that. In that sense, they are theoretically the people that you would imagine an internal Israelite Jewish perspective would have the greatest contempt for. And Shem Shamayim is mitkadesh because you show, actually in our society, we will hang even princes who go after even gerim grurim if they have thereby basically violated an oath, violated their word, violated whatever contract they made with these people. So it's a kind of amazing statement. It sort of starts in the Tanakh. Already the idea that the Givonim are not really the bad guys. That is to say, it seems like they're the bad guys at first, right? They are the deceptive ones. But in a certain fundamental sense, the Tanakh kind of takes the side of the Givonim in the sense of, well, maybe they got the better of you, they fooled you, but like you signed that deal, you have to abide by it. And Shaul is the bad one for thinking that he can go after them. Incidentally, as a side comment, it's one of a number of contextual pieces that I think is critical for understanding Shmuel's condemnation of Shaul in the Battle of Amalek, which is to say, Shaul, in the battle against Amalek, when you read it on its own, it's like, oh my God, the guy just had a heart. He was just nervous about massacring some people. Like, how could you get so mad at him? But actually, Shaul has no problem massacring people. Right? Like the sense in which Amalek is a real moment of weakness for him is, first of all, right, he wipes out all the kids of Amalek. He doesn't wipe out the animals, so he has no problem killing the children. But here too, in the broader context, we see when Shaul felt it was the right thing to go after the Givonim, he killed all the Givonim he could get his hands on. So in any event, I just think there's sort of a powerful story here, and the notion of what it means for societies to sort of keep bargains, sort of keep treaties that they have signed, even when they feel they were signed under false pretenses in one way or another. Okay, a couple comments here. Yeah, the injustice potentially of sort of vicarious punishment, that may be another piece here as well. And yes, the Midrash, which really takes up that point with respect to Shaul and Amalek, I think I can't remember if it's Kohelet Rabbah or Vayikra Rabba, but I think it's Kohelet Rabba. Okay, good. Let's finish out this piece. Okay. Uchtiv. Now, this uchtiv is just like a new point, but that's going back to the first verse we had. Remember about Baal Peor, Benot Moav, when there's this moment where the plague starts, God says to Moshe, Kach et kol Rashei Ha'am. So now the question is, Im Ha'am Chatu, Rashei Ha'am Machatu. If you look in the chapter there, it's the end of Parshat Balak, it says, Vayitzamed Ha'am Leva'al Peor. The people kind of attach themselves to the worship of Baal Peor. It doesn't say anything about the heads. So why would Moshe, why would God be telling Moshe what sounds like kifshuto is a pasuk that says, kach et kol rashei ha'am vehoka otam neged Hashem. That is to say, take the elders or the heads and hang them up. The assumption here is, well, that's crazy. That can't be. Maybe Zimri ben Salu, okay, of Shimon. He's the one who has the liaison in Ol Moed with Kozbi, fine, but all the Rashei Ha'am, what's going on? What did they do wrong? So Rav Yehuda Amarav has a different idea. Amar Rav Yehuda Amarav, Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, Chalek lahem batei dinim. This doesn't mean execute the elders. It means take all the people. Here, look at Rashi. He fills it out nicely. The Hachi Kamar, Kach kol Rashei Ha'am, take all the elders, veholech otam levatei dinim harbe, and set them up in different courts. That is to say, the Rashei Ha'am, the heads of the people, will be the judges. Quick, grab an execution squad. Okay? Veyidonu et ovrei ha'avera, veyadunu et ovrei ha'avera, vehoka otam et hamechuyavin, mipnei shetzamdu leva'al peor. Okay, judge not them, but take the leaders and judge those who sinned and hang them. That is to say, who's the otam? Those who are liable for attaching themselves to Baal Peor. And why are we saying hoka otam? Oved avodat kochavim beskila v'chol haniskalin nitlin. The punishment for idolatry in certainly the rabbinic understanding, but it's based at the end of Parshat Kedoshim. The punishment for idolatry is stoning, and anyone who is stoned is hung. So therefore, they're idolaters. It says hoka, hoka is hanging. Idolaters are stoned, and stoning leads to hanging. So it all comes together as a coherent package. All right, so that's what's going on there. Now, the question now the Gemara is gonna ask is, Maitama, why? Why do they have to be divided up into courts? Why don't you just make one court where they try all these people? Ilema mishum she'ein danim shnayim biyom echad. Ve'ama Rav Chista lo shanu ela b'shtei mitot. Ava b'mita achat danim. If you want to tell me, and we'll come to this principle in a moment, they had to set up multiple courts because you cannot execute, one court cannot execute two people in one day. If that's why, that would be a good reason to have multiple courts. No, that won't work, because Rav Chista said that principle, that Ein Danin Shnayim B'Yom Echad, only applies when it is two different kinds of death penalty. But if it's the same type of death penalty, you are allowed to bundle them together. Rather, there must have been a different reason for splitting them up into courts. Kadeshi Ashuv Chanonaf Misoil, which is of course what the verse says there at the end. That is to say, what do we want? I'll go back to this one death, two death in a minute. But Rashi here has a nice explication. Ella, Kedemuchach Krav, Yashuv Charon Af. That's what the verse says. Kesha Kadosh Baruchuro Eshekulam Asukin Badavar Umekanin Lichvodo. In order to turn God's anger away from the people, you want to show God, hey, we're on top of this. We're getting everyone involved as much as we can to take care of it. It was not a procedural issue. It was not an issue of, oh, we're not allowed technically to do it. They could have done them all in one court, but that would have looked like one zealous person. That would have looked like, oh, Pinchas, right, did something amazing. It would not have looked like the people are rising up to actually stamp out this problem. Also an interesting thing, particularly in the current moment, what it looks like for, what are the optics look like for sort of a government to deal with something as opposed to a society deal with something that's wrong. This notion of chiluk batei din, there being sort of multiple venues that are simultaneously addressing an injustice, is an interesting and kind of timely reflection, I think, with a lot of what we're thinking about now. So let me just close this piece out with further context here, and then I'll pause for some comments on this. So just to, I'm going to go back to one other thing in this document. This principle of Ein Danin Shnayim B'Yom Echad is an interesting one. It comes up in a Mishnah that's in a couple Prakim later, okay? And I'll just lead us to a Tosfot in a second. So the Mishnah, this line that Rashi already quoted, Kol HaNiskalin Nitlin, everyone who is stoned gets hung as the completion of that process. So the Mishnah gets into a discussion of, is that really true? Kol HaNiskalin Nitlin? So Rabbi Eliezer says, yeah. Ha'ish tolin oto panav klapei ha'am, va'isha panav klapei ha'etz. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. When a man is hung, his face is hung facing the people. His face is facing the people, whereas where a woman is hung, her face is towards the gallows. Seems to be some kind of concern, some, you know, presumption around dignity, which parts of the body are sexualized, theories of male and female role in public space and their body, etc. These sorts of things come up around funeral discussions and processions in the Mishnah as well. The point is, Rabbi Eliezer assumes both men and women are hung, just with a different procedure. Whereas Chachamim omrim ha'ish nitle ve'ein ha'isha nitleit. No, you do not ever hang women, say the sages. That is only something that's done to men. Maybe motivated by the same concern that's motivating Rabbi Eliezer, just more extreme, making it feel impossible to hang the female body at all, or maybe it's a different understanding. In any event, here's where our principle is going to come in. Amar lahen Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer answers, V'halo Shimon ben Shetach tala nashim be'ashkelon. What do you mean? There's a case when Shimon ben Shetach, who's back in the Maccabean period, he's at the time of Yanai HaMelech, there's a record, a memory of him hanging women from gallows in Ashkelon. And the response is, Amrulo, Shmonim Nashim Tala. Yeah, you're right. And he hung 80 of them in one day. Ve'ein danin shnayim beyom echad. And we have a principle that you cannot execute two people in one day. Therefore, whatever Shimon ben Shetach was doing was outside the bounds of normal law. From the fact that you see that he hung 80 people in one day, you see he was not operating according to criminal procedure. And therefore, the fact that he hung women is also not a precedent for what we're talking about. Okay, fascinating conversation on the hanging, the gender piece, etc. The point that the Mishnah wants it for is to sort of show a Shimon ben Shetach type of execution, forget about the gender piece of it, is not the way the courts are ever supposed to operate. A single court is only allowed to execute one person a day. And the Tosefta spells this out in a really dramatic form. Ein danin shnei danin dinin biyom echad. You cannot execute, basically settle two criminal trials in one day and execute both people. Afilu no'ef v'no'efet. Even a pair caught in adultery. It's one act, okay? You caught them with the same act. They could actually only be convicted, really, with the other one being convicted. Even in that case, Ella, Danina Tarishon, Ve'achar kach Danina Tasheni. You have to spread out the procedures for those two so that you never bunch them up in one day. Okay, so that now we see is what Rav Chista was modifying in our Gemara, where he was saying, yeah, I accept that principle, but only when it is two separate kinds of execution. When it's the same kind of execution, then you don't have that limitation and you can try them all together. The Tosfot jump on this, and they quote that Tosefta that I just cited. And they say, but what do you mean? And the Tosefta, it says, afilu noef venoefet, even the male and female adulterer together. But they both get the punishment of stoning. So you should be able to try them together if Rav Chisda is right. So they're in the Gemara, they raise this later on, and they say, perhaps she was a bat kohen. Perhaps it's only in a case where the adulteress is the daughter of a kohen, in which case, because of her lineage, she gets put in the category of sreifa as opposed to skila, and therefore it can all work out as a precedent. Now, in reality, probably Rav Chisda either didn't have or didn't care about that Tosefta. This is one of those interesting cases where what is canonical and what you are accountable to sort of grows over time. The Mishnah says what it says. We have the Tosefta, which the Gemara ended up having access to as well. Rav Chisda may or may not have thought of that as a normative text, and therefore he may have felt free to put a rider on the Mishnah that didn't comport with the Tosefta Zafilu Noef and Noefet. But here you see, once someone feels accountable to the Mishnah and the Tosefta and Rav Chisda, they're going to have to put an Okimta, put some limiting factor on that text to make it a little more narrowly drawn. All right, I'm going to press on. You'll jump in with comments as they come to you. Okay. So we're moving on to the next part of the Mishnah, analyzing it. Another pretty short sugya here. So going back to the Mishnah, the next line in the Mishnah is, Dinei mamonot gomrin bo vayom bein lizchut bein lachova, dinei nefashot gomrin bo vayom lizchut uveyom shela acharav lechova. When it comes to monetary cases, you can start and end them in one day. Doesn't matter whether you fine for the plaintiff, for the defendant, doesn't matter. You simply can decide it in one day. With capital cases, you can finish them the same day if you acquit. But if you want to convict, you must wait to deliver the conviction and certainly the execution until the following day. Okay, so again, we're going to ask, Menahane Mile, where's that from? What's the source of that principle? This is an amazing reading. Amar Rabbi Chanina de Amar Kra, Meleati Mishpat, Tzedek Yalinba, Ve'ata Meratzchim. Okay, so this is a pasuk from Yeshayahu, Haftarah for Shabbat Chazon. Yeshayahu is vilifying the city of Yerushalayim. Echa Haita Lezona, Kirya Ne'emana. The faithful and loyal city has become a harlot. Meleati mishpat. It used to be full of justice. Tzedek yalinba. Righteousness used to dwell there, used to sleep there, and now it's full of murderers. Okay, so the plain sense of the verse is this used to be a just, wonderful city, and now it's just a bunch of murderers. But how is it read here? Meleati mishpat, it used to be filled with justice. How so? Tzedek yalinba. They would make sure to have justice wait a night. That is to say, they used to sleep on their intended convictions in capital cases. Ve'ata, now they don't do that anymore. Therefore, they are murderers. That is to say, the murder is not now just murdering random people. Judges are referred to as murderers if they execute someone the same day they began the trial. Okay, so simply moving that fast is the act of murder that is being condemned. All right, that's proof one from Rabbi Chanina that you therefore got to wait the night. The Rava Amar Mehacha, Ashru Chamotz, which is also from Yeshayahu. There it says here on the side, you see my cursor. Limdu hetev, dirshu mishpat, ashru chamotz, shiftu yatom, rivu almana. Yeshayahu was telling them what to do. Study well, seek out justice. This phrase, ashru chamotz, a little bit obscure. Judge, that is to say favorably, the orphan, fight for the widow. What's ashru chamotz, says Rava? Ashru dayan shemichametz et dino. You know, sort of applaud the judge who literally ferments his judgment. That is to say, lets it sit around. does not rush to execute the same day. That's the kind of judge you want. Okay? Now, just pausing here for a minute, I think it's pretty clear, right? Rabbi Hanina and Rava are not really suggesting that we had no idea whether you need to wait the night before, you know, executing. But a close reading of Yeshayahu Aleph revealed that principle. They obviously already know this. The Mishnah knows this. This is based on some sort of deeper intuitive sense that's guiding so much of this chapter of being very, very careful with the capital system. But the desire here, I think what's more significant about this, is not so much the derivation. It's giving it a tone of something that's not sort of just a mere procedural point, right? Rabbi Hanina and Rava are desirous of fitting it into a prophetic condemnation that really turns someone who is careless with a capital case that way into a murderer, and turns someone who does something that you might initially perceive of as being derelict in their duty, right? Like mechametzet dino, it's like saying, oh God, that you can't even bother to fill out the paperwork, close out the case. No, that actually, the person who's dragging their feet on the procedure and saying, let's sleep on it, come back tomorrow, that person is to be lauded. All right, now they finish out sort of the game of midrashic ping pong here. V'idach, so okay, what's Rabbi Hanina gonna say about Ashru Chamotz? Like if he doesn't think it comes from there, so what does he think that means? Ashru Chamotz, and it may even be chamutz here, velo chometz. Validate or go after the one who has been soured rather than the one who is doing the souring. Okay, Rashi will illuminate for us what's happening here. V'idach mibaya leilahach drasha. The other side here, Rabbi Hanina, needs ashru chamotz for something else. It's not free to prove or to anchor the delay of execution, needs it for something else that appears in Bava Kama. Minayin shenizkakin latovea tchila. How do you know that you deal with the plaintiff's claim first before the nitba, the defendant's claim? Kegon, what does that mean? Hatovea tchaveiro ladin shehilvahu ve'eino meshalem. Let's say someone comes and sues their colleague in court and says, I lent you money and you haven't paid me back. I lent you $100 and I'm suing you for the $100 that you owe me. Vizetoano, and then the defendant claims, Mashkon hayali biyadcha venitkalkel o avad. No, I gave you a security deposit for the loan and it got ruined, or you lost it. So actually, I'm claiming you lost something of mine. Nizkakin tchila beitin litfiyata toveya ad sheyehe mamono biyado ve'achar kach nizkakin ledina mashkon. How do you decide which of those cases gets priority? You go first to the plaintiff and you recover his $100. And then you go to the defendant and recover whatever losses he has from the security deposit being lost. And how do we know that? Ashru chamotz. Take care of the one who has been sort of lost money. Hachziku et hanigzal velo et hagozel. Hold up the one who has been stolen from and not the one who is stealing. That is to say, the mashkon, maybe the guy was, the security deposit, he was careless with it, but the guy who borrowed money and is refusing to repay is actually just stealing. So that's how you know that that's the priority. All right, point is, it assigns that verse to something else. V'idach, okay. Hai meleati mishpat my avid. So what is Rava going to do with this meleati mishpat verse? Tzedek yalin ba'atam ve'atam ratzchim, my avid lei. Kid Rabbi Elazar, Mar Rabbi Yitzchak. He uses that verse for the statement of Amar Rabbi Elazar, Mar Rabbi Yitzchak. Kol ta'anit shemalinin bo et hatzdaka ke'ilu shofech damim. Shneemar meleati mishpat tzedek yalin ba ve'atam ratzchim. Rabbi Yitzchak used that same verse to prove something else. which is when you have a fast day, if you go to bed on the fast day without giving tzedakah, it is like you have killed someone. How do you know that? Meleati mishpat, tzedek yalin ba. Tzedek being read here as tzedakah, and not delaying it, but tzedek yalin ba, you should go to sleep already having done tzedakah. If you are doing a fast day, which is about repairing society, and you go to sleep the night before the fast day without having given tzedakah, it is like you have murdered someone. Ata meratzchim. Now, why? The next line in the Gemara indicates that there's some context here. Vahane mile berifta v'tamre. That only applies with bread and dates. Aval bezuze chite v'sa'are letlan ba. But with money, wheat, and barley, that concern does not apply, and you can go to sleep before you distribute it. So Rashi explains here, what's the social context here? And it's interesting to think how there might be still some analogs today, or what we might make an analog in thinking about a ta'anit zibur. Kol ta'anit, regilin hayu belele ta'anit lasot tzedakah. That there was actually a sort of practice that developed to do, perform acts of tzedakah on the night before a fast day, v'hayu einei ha'aniyim nesuot lechach. And as a result of that practice, poor people became dependent on that. They started to say, oh, it's Shivasar v'tamuz. We're going to get a big distribution the night before. And they count on that. V'im yalinu nimtze'u aniyim re'evim shenish'anu al kach. If they end up then going to sleep, without giving that out, the poor people will be hungry that night because they relied on it. The Hane Mile, and this explains the limited approach, b'makom sh'regilin l'chaleg rifta v'tamre, davar muchan le'echol. What's common to bread and dates? You just take them and you eat them right away. But money or wheat or barley, if the way that things are distributed to the poor is either by giving them cash or by giving them stores that they can then use up and prepare as food, lo nishanu ha'aniyim aleihem oto halayla, veletlan ba'ad lemachar. Those are things that no one's expecting to get a meal out of in the next hour, and therefore you're not obligated to do it that night, even if that's the convention. All right, I wrote the check the next morning. The check is the check. The person can't be counting on the check for dinner. Right. Could ask interesting questions in an age of Venmo and instant transfer and purchasing, whether these things are different, but I think we get the spirit and the idea and the way in which it's being read back into that verse of Tzedek Yalin Ba Ve'atam Meratzchim, and therefore that accounts for everyone taking the drashot that they do and the ones that they don't. Okay, that's sugya number two. Let's look at sugya number three. So here, we now get back to the Mishnah's claim. Lefichach, therefore, ein danin lo be'erev Shabbat ve'lo be'erev Yom Tov. Because you have to wait the night on a capital case, you can't start a capital trial on Friday. And now the Gemara is going to play out exactly why that's so. If you're in that doc, you can look. I made a little chart that may be helpful for you. I think it's at the end there, for following some of the procedure here. Okay, my tama, mishum delo efshar. There's literally no way to begin a trial on Friday, a capital trial on Friday, and have it work out. And we're going to learn a bunch of fascinating little details here, of sort of mini principles of why that's so. Hechi li'avid, what do you want to do? We're going to get five proposals for how you might be able to have a trial on Friday, start on Friday, and why they all fail. Lidaine b'ma'alei shabta v'ligmarei ledina b'ma'alei shabta. Well, why don't you just start the trial on Friday and end it on Friday? We know that you are allowed to end the trial on the same day in a capital case as long as you acquit. So the answer here is pretty obvious. Dilma chazutam l'chova. So because you don't know, you might decide that you want to convict. And once you decide you're going to convict, you've got to wait and push off the judgment till the next day. And the assumption is, and you won't be able to continue on Shabbat. The Gemara is going to now say, well, why not? Right? Proposal two is, Lidainei b'ma'ale shabta, v'ligmerei b'shabta, v'liktalei b'shabta. Fine. Start the trial on Friday, finish it on Saturday, and then kill the person on Saturday. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is, ein ritzicha docha et Shabbat. Actually, you are not justified in executing someone on Shabbat. It's a violation of Shabbat to execute someone. And since you don't have a clear pikuach nefesh override or something like that, you can't justify it. Just as a side point here, look at the Tosfot here. This is a great one. So they're sort of like, why not? What's the problem with executing someone? So they say, bisreifa nicha. I understand if it's execution by burning, fine. Afilu leman de amar mekokel behavara patur. We'll come back to that. De yesh bachilul shabbat mishum ptila. De amar mali bishul ptila mali bishul samamanim. Because actually, what the Mishnah understands sreifa to be is not burning at the stake, but you can tune out to this for a minute if it's too aggravating or traumatic to listen to. You actually pry open the mouth of the person being executed, you light something on fire, and you drop it into their throat, and basically that kills them from the inside. The lighting of the flame, that ptila, that's a melacha, that's fire on Shabbat, you can't do it. So, all right, that I understand. But what about all the other executions? Just like choking someone, beheading, throwing rocks, maybe it's muktzah, but what's the problem? Sharchave mitot nami, afilu leman de amar de mekokel v'chabura patur. Even if you think that someone who is just wounding someone on Shabbat, because it is mekalkel, there is no constructive purpose to it whatsoever. It cannot count as a malacha because it does not actually create anything in the world. It's just destructive. Even if you think that people who, you know, punch each other and give each other bruises on Shabbat have not at least biblically violated Shabbat, this is different. Hacha chashiv tikkun. This is different because an execution is a tikkun, not a kilkul. There is something constructive that happens because it is a form of atonement. All right. Now this, obviously we spent a lot of time talking about this, but I bring you this both because it's a little, you know, entertaining to see them sort of play out the details here. But there's actually something very profound there where the Tosfot are recognizing that the whole system here, right? And it's very important, I think, not to forget this throughout the chapter. I think it is a mistake to read the rabbinic take on capital punishment as being anti-capital punishment, as if it is nothing but a destructive system. There is actually simultaneously a deep sense of the incredible power and atoning power, both for the individual and the broader society, that capital punishment and the justice that it represents can serve, and a deep, overwhelming fear that you will probably screw it up. But a real holding of those two together, right? I think that's the accurate picture here. And you see that, yesh lo kapara. Like, and therefore, when contemplating doing it on Shabbat, you cannot do an act like that on Shabbat under the guise of, well, it's just destructive. It's not a Shabbat violation. No. This is like a real serious, if we get it right, it's a real serious constructive act that therefore has no place of being done on Shabbat. Okay, so therefore, step one is you can't just start and end the trial on Friday because you might need to wait the night. Step two is you can't plan to continue it and end it on Shabbat because you can't execute someone on Shabbat. Suggestion three, veliktale le'urta. Okay, so execute him on Saturday night, meaning start the trial on Friday and the deliberations on Saturday. There's no problem with the procedure and the voting and all of that, it seems to be on Shabbat. We'll come back to that in a second. And the problem was executing. So execute them on Saturday night. Neged Hashemesh Va'enon. No, we already learned the execution must happen during the day. Okay, so now number four. Veligmere ledine b'shabta, veliktele b'chad b'shabta. Okay, well, why don't you just start the trial on Friday, give the conviction on Saturday, and wait till Sunday during the day to do the execution. Nimtza ata me'ane et dino. No, you are then engaging in inui hadin, which you could render as torturing the judgment. You could render as inflicting pain as part of the process of the conviction. What does it mean? Sitting on death row when there's hope of appeal is one thing. Sitting on death row waiting to be executed simply because the state has not gotten around to executing you, but where you know you are going to be killed, that is already an injustice. So inui hadin is also impossible. You can only execute people right after you make the decision. Again, we're not getting into appeal and how you might stretch out, you know, how the Mishnah and the Gemara might think about that as an extended process. But once you know what's going to happen, you have to do it right away. It's out of, we could say, consideration for both potentially the mental state of the convict, but also I think there's a broader claim here about the ways in which it perverts the justice for the broader society. There's something manipulative as opposed to getting to this very important end. Here too, by the way, I want to say, I think there's like an element here you feel of, if you're going to do this, it's the most important thing to do. It can't sort of become part of some bureaucratic backlog, right? The only justification for killing someone is you must kill them right now. Nidaine, the fifth, Nidaine, this is on some level the most poignant, Nidaine b'male shabta v'nigmere b'chad b'shabta. This is the most obvious. And I think someone asked this in an earlier session. Like, how did they not have trials that went on several weeks? Well, at least not in this form. Proposing start the trial on Friday and then just go into recess over Shabbat and finish it on Sunday. You cannot do that. Why? Minshu ta'amayu. They will forget the arguments that they advanced for the conviction. And it's critical that the arguments be clear when they are doing the conviction. Af al gav dishnei sofrei adayanin omdin lifnehem v'chotvin divrei hamezakin v'divrei hamachayvin. And even though you'll say, but what are you talking about? We have this whole thing where they have clerks who are writing everything. The stenographers are there writing down everything so that they can be referred back to. That's not enough. Nehi de befuma katvin, liba de enashe inshe. Even though they write down befuma, they write down that which the person said, right? What can the stenographer put down? The words. Oh, so and so, Rabbi Akiva made this argument and I recorded the words that he said. But what is in the heart of people gets forgotten. Look at Rashi here. Min shelahota amayu shenasu v'natnu v'dikdeku b'yom rishon. They're going to forget the reasons. And even though those are formally written down, liba de'enashe inshe, liba de'enashe lo katve. They don't write because they can't write what it is people were feeling when they articulated those arguments. Ve'afa gav shezachur lo liyesod hata'am. Even though, sure, from what was recorded, he'll remember the foundational point, the basic point of the argument that he offered for execution or for acquittal. Nishkach milibo yishuvo l'ta'amo. What you no longer remember is, why was I so convinced that was right? I know that's what I think. I know that's what I thought, but I no longer can fully pull up, why was I so convinced that was the right way to go? Ve'en yachol liyashvo latet ta'am hagun kebarishona. And you won't be able to sort of settle what you're articulating to give as good a support for what you were arguing as you were at first. Now, this Rashi is actually a little bit cryptic in the sense of, I think the question is, to what end? And I think you can read it in a couple of different ways. Like one may be, what we really need to make sure that everyone's on top of sort of all their most passionate feeling and clarity about their arguments, so that as we come to vote, when we're closing the din, we make sure like no stone has been unturned in any direction. I wonder if there's also something here with the liba de enashe of, if you're gonna execute someone, you have to be like totally clear in that moment with a clear feeling of, yeah, I feel very clear about why this must be so, as opposed to the ways in which, you know, you take notes in a class, you go back and study for the exam, and you're like, yeah, I guess I remember learning that, and I'll sort of commit that to memory now, but you're not in the moment of actually embodying that idea. And I wonder if that's some element of what's happening here as well. I would love some thoughts on some of the technical pieces here, in terms of what things in contemporary US courts, either in terms of delay, you know, going from conviction to execution, or any notion of having to wait some degree of time before reaching a conviction, what parallels we have or don't have on that. So if those with any experience on this want to jump in either on unmuting or the chat, that would be great.
Well, Ethan, I could say, as somebody who's luckily with no death penalty, but as a judge who's tried a lot of murder cases and other serious cases, I would do it exactly the opposite. Hmm. That is, if there was, say, first of all, none of those trials take a day. They take weeks sometimes, certainly several days. But it was always my practice, and I think it's the better practice. Suppose we were supposed to finish at 4:45. Mm-hmm. So suppose it's 4:00. Do you send the case to the jury at 4:00 or at 4:15? Mm-hmm. And my view was no, that I didn't want the jury to feel like, I didn't want to risk the possibility that the jury would rush just to get out of there. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that they had enough time to really consider it. And so I didn't want to risk that. And so I would sort of let them start fresh in the morning, and no jury ever complained about that. The other thing, of course, is that, you know, we do exactly the opposite. People sit on death row for years.
Right. I mean, on the first point you're saying, that is somewhat in line. It sounds like it's much more up to your discretion, but it's somewhat in line with the notion of, to the extent that getting a conviction in one day is analogous to the giving it to the jury right at 4:15, then there's some notion of, no, sorry, right? The second we feel that there's some pressure here. And truth be told, actually, I hadn't thought about this before until you articulated it. When you combine it with the notion that you have to carry out the execution during daylight and you're not supposed to wait the night, then effectively doing it in one day may compound the sense of rushing of, well, we got to get this guy on the gallows by 5:57, right? And therefore, to the extent we want to go that direction, maybe we should push harder. But yeah, just to ask a follow-up on that. So is that basically up to, that's up to your discretion, basically. There's no regulation of how quickly
No.
or...
No, it's just what's the best, fairest way to conduct a trial.
Right. And yeah. So you couldn't, yeah. I mean, I imagine it's generally unimaginable, but like theoretically under law, you could start and end and convict in one day.
There are empirical studies of parole boards granting parole. And when they meet at 9, 10, 10 o'clock, 11, and they're fresh, they'll consider it more, and there's a more likelihood of granting parole. As they get later in the day and get tired, then they just want to finish it and they deny it. Then they take a break for lunch. Again, after lunch, they're fresh. Again, mm-hmm. they'll grant parole more. Later in the day, again, they just want to get rid of it and they'll deny it. I mean, there have been studies to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Any other folks with the legal context here to weigh in?
Just an observation, which is when the Gemara says liba de inchi, you don't know the heart of people, we all think of ourselves, or like to think of ourselves, as rational actors, right? The evidence comes in, we make really rational decisions based on the evidence, and we strive to. But at the end of the day, we are emotional decision makers. Mm-hmm. Every human being, just the nature of humanity. And Chazal understood that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very poignant line there. And as I said, not, I think, totally clear what all the dimensions of it may be. Couple other comments here. Yeah, you know, governors and clemency and stays of execution. There's no one with that power in this system, right? Again, this largely imagined system, constructed system. There's no one with that power. The trade-off, I would say, is right. The system here generally just errs in making it near impossible, to convict someone. And it's as opposed to, I think a system with clemency is a little more assuming, yeah, every now and then an injustice is going to be done and we'll have a fail-safe character, who can sort of pull the plug there. That's not built in here. As we've talked about, the system really goes the other way. We'll come back to this later, which is God is the executioner in waiting for all the people who are going to fall through the cracks. So it's an opposite system in a way. It's a theological system that is more irresponsible in terms of statecraft, as opposed to a system that says, well, we've got to, I mean, putting the death penalty in particular, aside, we've got to have a capital system that is going to, take responsibility, in one way or the other for this. We don't feel like we can rely on God to clean up the mess. That's certainly like the sort of secular take on it. But then is there someone who can play God by giving clemency? But this system, interestingly, like God is the one who's going to make sure that the people who deserve to be executed, but who you really have no ability or no business executing, will get caught. So it's a very different kind of balance, which I think is interesting. A couple of people commented on the Shabbat stuff. Which, yes, is interesting, that they contemplate conducting a trial on Shabbat. So here, too, the question is, how much is that serious? The Tosfot are wise to this also. Here, ligmere ledine b'shabta. Afagav ditnan b'perak mashilin eloi mishum shvut lo danin. There's a Mishnah Shleima, there's a whole Mishnah in Masechet Beitzah that says you can't have court on Shabbat. So they're sort of like, why is the Gemara playing this out here? So you could say, it's playing it out because it's doing a thought experiment, not because it's really taking seriously. So Adam, when you're talking about, the scribes need to write, it's like, they never really thought that, that was the case. But Tosfot take it very seriously. And they say, I'm not sure actually what they would say about your question of writing, but they say, Hainu davka dine mamonot. No. Actually, I mean, you'll see they take up writing, but it's not clear to me exactly what they think in the capital case. Hainu davka dine mamonot gzeira shema yichtov. In monetary cases, the Mishnah forbids holding a case on Shabbat. Why? For fear you will come to write. You'll end up recording things. Aval, but dine nefashot, in capital cases, ein le'esor mita amze. You shouldn't forbid this. Shekvar katvu me'atmo divrei ha'mizakin v'divrei ha'mechayvin. Because they already wrote down the arguments yesterday of the people who argued in each direction. Now, it doesn't totally answer, because what if, we've talked about there's a masau matan on the next day, they can reopen the discussion. And if someone says something new, so what are they going to do? Write it? That seems like that's unimaginable. Not write it, but then that seems like that could lead to a mistrial. I'm not sure whether this is a totally coherent response, but you do see Tosfot do assume maybe you would find some way to have a capital trial, extend through Shabbat in that way. But the idea seems to be, coming back to this question of the timing of these cases, you wouldn't be able to start on Friday for all the reasons we went through. If you started on Tuesday, but it went many, many days, right? Could you then take a break before Shabbat and then resume on Sunday, as long as it wasn't sort of already understood to be the last day? That's less clear. What I'll remind you, and again, this is hard to know, how much is this really reflecting a reality or just reflecting the limits of what we're imagining here? The tone of all of these things makes it sound like the normal thing would be that a case would begin and end in one day, both monetary and capital. And the chidush, the unusual, unexpected feature of the capital case, is we make you wait till the next day, right? But no, what do you mean it's going to go on forever? And some of this goes back to, we think of capital cases today as gathering all the evidence, gathering all the testimony, cross-examining all the things that then happen, and where it can take weeks to put all of that into the record. Their dinei nefashot seems to be based a lot more in arguments from scripture as to whether the person standing trial deserves the penalty. That is to say, yeah, there's some witnesses, they show up, you like do that before, but it seems like the trial that we're talking about here is actually post the gathering of the evidence. And really what then happens is, given this evidence, what do we say? So it's much more in some ways, as opposed to like, you know, a court that is a trial court, we might want to better think of it as, it's essentially like, you know, a Supreme Court conference, okay? The facts have been decided, we're now arguing over the question of law, and yes, the deliberation over the case would not normally necessarily take more than a day among the judges in terms of how they will vote, and the interesting thing is, if they're voting on a capital thing, we make them sleep on it. So that, I think, fills in some of the details of what we've wondered, what are they imagining? But here we really see it when we get to the Shabbat piece, they're really imagining a 1 or 2 day process. And therefore, as long as you don't start on Friday, I think in most of the cases they're imagining, then you'll be in the clear. Okay, interesting stuff.
Can I just quickly-
Please, go ahead.
Yeah, it struck me. Liba de Anashe Inche, it's the exact same letters.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's Lashon Nefela Lashon, or even if you could read the Liba de Anashe Anashe, the heart of human is human. It's not written out in public, or this is very striking.
It's definitely a literary play there. And I don't know how deep it's going or how much they mean to read it in different ways, but yeah, absolutely. The forgetting being a person and forgetting and the different roots that are there is fascinating. All right, terrific. Great to be back with everyone. See you in another week. We're going to be starting a big, tough sugya that's going to take us through a page and a half and a bunch of Midrash Halacha. So I think it's going to take us two sessions to conquer that one, but we'll cover a nice bit of ground with it. All right, see ya.